quiet, save for the slow bump, bump, bump of his heart beating in the pre-dawn. He craned his neck, stared down at the remains of his campfire. White smoke trickled up out of the embers. Tobias wiped the dew off the long barrel of his high-powered rifle and shouldered his Kelty. He walked to the edge of the grove and crouched down between a pair of saplings. It was damn cold. First freeze of the season couldn't be more than a night or two away. He took a compass out of his pocket. He was facing east. A series of meadows and forests gradually climbed toward a range of mountains in the far distance. 50, possibly 60 miles away. He didn't know with any certainty, but he held out hope that they were what had once been called the Sawtooth. If they were, he was almost home. Raising his rifle to his shoulder, he stared through the telescopic sight and glassed the terrain ahead. There was no breeze. The weeds in the open fields stood motionless. 2 miles out, he spotted bison, a cow and her calf grazing. The next stretch of forest looked to be 3 or 4 miles away. Long time to be in the open. He slung the rifle over his shoulder and walked away from the protection of the trees. 200 yards out, he glanced back at the grove of pines dwindling behind him. It had been a good night there. Fire and tea and the closest thing to a restful night's sleep he could ever hope to experience in the wild. He walked into the sun, stronger than he'd felt in days. Between his black beard, black cowboy hat, and black duster that fell to his ankles, he looked like a vagabond prophet sent to roam the world. And in some ways, perhaps he was. He hadn't made the notation in his journal yet, but this was day 1,287 of his trek. He'd made it as far west as the Pacific and as far north as where the great port city of Seattle had once stood. He'd nearly been killed a dozen times. Had killed 44 Abbeys, 39 with a revolver, 3 with his Bowie knife. 2 in hand-to-hand combat that he had come very close to losing. And now, he just needed to get home. Not only for the warm bed that awaited him and the promise of sleep without the ever-present threat of death, not just for the food and the long-dreamt-of sex with the woman he loved, but because he had some news to report. My God, did he have some news. Chapter 9. Ethan followed Marcus down the Level 2 corridor past a series of doors labeled Lab A, Lab B, Lab C. Near the far end, within spitting distance of the stairwell, Ethan's escort stopped at a door inset with a circle of glass. Marcus pulled out his keycard. "I don't know how long I'm going to be," Ethan said, "but I'll have them notify you when I'm ready to go back to town." "It's not a problem. I'll be by your side the whole time." "No, you won't." "Sheriff, my orders, go cry to your boss. You may be my driver, but you aren't my shadow. Not anymore. And while you're at it, wrangle up Alyssa's reports on her mission." Ethan snatched the young man's keycard, swiped it through the reader, and shoved it back into his chest. Stepping across the threshold, he turned and stared the escort down as he shut the door in his face. The room wasn't dark, but it was dim, like a theater 5 minutes before the movie starts. A 5x5 stack of monitors glowed on the wall straight ahead. There was another door to the right of the screens that was accessed by a keycard entry. Ethan had never been granted access to surveillance. A man wearing a headset turned in his swivel chair. "I was told you could help me," Ethan said. The man stood, short-sleeved, button-down, adorned with a clip-on tie, balding, mustached, what appeared to be a coffee stain on his lapel. He looked like he belonged in mission control, and the room certainly emanated a nerve-center vibe. Ethan closed the distance between them, but he didn't offer his hand. Said, "I'm sure you know plenty about me, but I'm afraid I don't even know your name."
"I'm Ted. I head up the surveillance group."
Ethan had tried to prepare himself for this moment, for meeting Pilcher's number 3, the man tasked with spying on the people of Wayward Pines in their most private moments. The urge to break his nose was even stronger than Ethan had anticipated. "Have you watched Teresa and me together?"
"You're investigating Alyssa's murder?" Ted asked.
"That's right."
"She was a great woman. I want to do whatever I can to help."
"Glad to hear that.
Please, have a seat.
Ethan followed Ted over to the monitors. They sat down in swivel chairs on wheels. The control panel looked ready-made to fly an alien spacecraft. Multiple keyboards and touchscreen technology that looked more advanced than anything Ethan remembered from his world.
Before we start, Ethan said, I want to ask you something.
Sure.
All you do is sit in here and eavesdrop on private lives, correct?
Ted's eyes seemed to cloud.
Was that shame?
That is my life.
Were you aware of Alyssa's mission in town?
I was.
Okay, so here's my question. You're in command of the most sophisticated surveillance system I've ever seen. How did you miss her murder?
We don't catch everything here, Mr. Burke. There are thousands of cameras in town, but most of them are indoors. We had a far more extensive exterior network when Pines began 14 years ago, but the elements have exacted considerable damage. They've killed cameras, drastically limited our eyesight.
So whatever happened to Alyssa
occurred in a blind spot, yes.
These blind spots, do you know where they are?
Ted turned his attention to the controls, his fingers moving at light speed across an array of touchscreens. The camera feeds vanished. 25 monitors now merged into a single image, an aerial photograph of Wayward Pines.
Ted said, So we're looking at the town and the valley. Pretty much every square foot of real estate inside the boundary of the electrified fence. We can push in anywhere we want.
The image zoomed down into the school, the playground equipment crystallizing into sharp focus.
Is this real time? Ethan asked.
No, this photo was taken years ago, but it's the grid upon which all of our tracking relies.
Ted tapped the screen at his fingertips. A day-glow overlay appeared. Most of the town was covered. Ted pointed at the screens.
Everywhere you see this overlay, we have a current, real-time, microchip-triggered camera feed. But you'll notice black spots, even within the coverage.
He tapped his controls, and a single house filled the screen. The overhead perspective changed to a three-dimensional, street-level view. With a swipe of his finger, the Victorian's windows and wood siding stripped away, and the image became an interactive blueprint.
You'll note that there are three blind spots in this residence. However, the day-glow overlay was replaced with solid red. There are no what we call death spots. This house, like every other residence in town, is sufficiently mic'd to capture anything above 30 decibels.
How loud is 30 decibels?
Ted whispered,
A library conversation.
He returned the screens to the aerial image of Pines with the day-glow overlay. So aside from a few blind spots in each house, most of indoor Pines is thoroughly wired. But once you get outside, even in town, the system begins to show cracks in its veneer. Look at all the black areas. There's a backyard with no visual surveillance whatsoever. The cemetery is a disaster, just a few cameras here and there. And as you move away from the center of Pines and follow the cliffs, it only gets worse. Look at these blind spots on the south side. 20-acre stretches of completely unmonitored terrain. Now, in theory, we have a way to handle that. Ted punched in something on a keyboard. A new overlay meshed with the day-glow. Hundreds of red blips appeared. The vast majority clustered in a 6-block radius near the center of town. Some were moving.
Recognize those? Ted asked.
The microchips.
We're reading 460 signals, one short.
That's because I'm sitting here with you.
Correct.
Ted moved the cursor over a stationary blip in a building on Main Street. He tapped the touchscreen. A text bubble blossomed. Ethan read, Brad Fisher.
I believe you had dinner with Brad and his wife last night. It's 10:11 a.m. and Mr. Fisher is in his law office. Right where he's supposed to be. Of course, all this data can be massaged any number of ways.
Every blip disappeared except for Fisher's. The timestamp at the bottom of the screen began to run backward. His blip moved out of the building, north up Main Street, and into his house.
How far back can you go? Ethan asked.
All the way to Mr. Fisher's integration.
The red dot raced all over town, months rewinding.
Years. And I can give him a trail, Ted said.
A trail appeared and scribbled everywhere like someone pushing a stylus across the screen.
Impressive, Ethan said.
Of course, you understand our problem.
System works until people cut out their microchips.
It's not an easy or painless procedure. Of course you know that.
So what exactly do you do all day? Ethan asked.
You mean how does one go about monitoring an entire town?
Yeah.
Put on that headset.
Ethan grabbed it off the console.
Can you hear me?
Ted's voice came loud and clear through the speakers.
Yep.
Ted's fingers worked the touchscreen, and the image of Wayward Pines and Brad Fisher's lifelong trajectory switched back to 25 separate images.
I'm one of the 3 real-time surveillance techs, Ted said. Through that door over there, we have 4 more surveillance techs reviewing flagged footage and audio round the clock, tracking persons of interest, generating reports, communicating with our in-town team, with you. Do you understand how the system gathers and sorts data?
No.
I'm not saying video isn't crucial, but it's really the audio that we lean most heavily on. Our system runs state-of-the-art voice recognition software, which pings off certain words, tones of voice. We're not looking as closely at the actual words as the emotions behind them. We also have body language recognition, but it's less effective.
Care to demonstrate?
Sure, bear with me. It'll be disorienting at first.
The screens began to change. Ethan saw a woman washing dishes. A schoolroom with Megan Fisher pointing at a blackboard. The Riverside Park, empty. A man sitting in a chair in a house staring into nothing. A man and woman fucking in a shower. It went on like this. Images coming faster and faster. Snippets of audio. Pieces of conversation meaningless and out of context, like a child turning through stations on a radio dial.
You catch that? Ted asked.
No, what?
The images froze. One of them filled the screens.
The view looked down from a ceiling at a woman leaning against a refrigerator, her crossed arms outlined in dayglow.
There, Ted said. That's a defensive posture. See the recognition overlay?
A man stood in front of her, his face out of view.
Let's see if we can't capture a better angle.
3 different camera views of the kitchen streamed past too quickly for Ethan to process any of it.
Nope, that's as good as it gets.
Ethan watched Ted's right hand raise a digital volume bar. The eavesdropping upon conversation became prominent in his headset. The woman said,
But I saw you with her.
The man said, When?
Yesterday. You guys were sitting at the same table in the library. We're friends, Donna, that's all.
How do I know it's not more than that?
Because you trust me? Because I love you and would never do anything to hurt you?
Ted killed the volume.
Okay, I remember this couple. He is actually cheating on her. He's done it with at least 4 women I can think of. Real scumbag.
So you won't continue to monitor this?
No, we will. He typed as he talked. I'm flagging this camera feed right now. Later today, one of my techs will scan Mr. Cheater's footage from the last week or so. Confirm none of his trysts are getting out of control. Mr. Pilcher and Pam will have surveillance reports on their desks first thing tomorrow.
And then?
They'll take whatever action they deem necessary.
You mean they'll stop him from doing this?
If his behavior is seen as a threat to the general peace, absolutely.
What will they do to him?
Ted looked up from the controls and smiled.
You mean, what will you do?
All likelihood, you'll be the one to handle it, Sheriff Burke.
Ted reset the screens to the single aerial view of Wayward Pines.
Now that you have a basic understanding of how our system works and its capabilities, I'm at your disposal. What do you want to see?
Ethan leaned back in his chair.
Can you pull up Alyssa's tracking chip?
A red blip appeared in a house at the east end of town. Ted said,
Obviously that's not her. The night of her death, Alyssa removed her microchip and left it in her bedside table drawer.
I didn't even know Pilcher had a daughter. How's he holding up?
To be honest, I don't know. David's a complicated man. Values above all control of his emotions. He's grieving privately, I'm sure.
Where's Alyssa's mother?
Not here.
Ted said in a tone that discouraged further inquiry.
All right, let me see her movement around town going back 1 week.
Ted worked at the controls.
The blip went from the house to the community gardens and back. Then it moved out of the house and off the map.
Was that when she was last inside the mountain? Ethan asked.
Yes.
Alyssa's microchip moved back into town, up and down Main Street, the community gardens, then home again. Ethan stood up from his chair and stretched his arms over his head.
Can you pull another microchip? Ethan asked.
Sure, whose?
Kate Hewson's?
You mean Kate Ballinger.
Ted keyed in her name and tapped a panel with his right hand. A second blip materialized in another part of town. Ethan asked,
Is it possible for you to isolate all instances where these two dots were in the same place at the same time?
Now you're talking. How far back?
Same date range, starting 1 week ago?
Ethan watched Ted input the parameters into a data field. When he looked back at the screens, there were four paired blips on the aerial map.
Can you pull the video and audio feed from each encounter? Thought you'd never ask.
Ted exploded the first of two pairs of dots in the community gardens.
This was the first encounter, he said. Happened 6 days ago. Give me a second. Let me find the best angle.
He cruised through a number of vantage points, far too fast for Ethan to comprehend anything.
Okay, here's our winner.
Kate filled the screen. She wore a summer dress, sunglasses, a straw hat. She strolled toward the camera between rows of raised flower beds. A woven basket dangled from one arm, bulging with vegetables and fruit. The back of someone's head filled the lower part of the screen.
Is that Alyssa? Ethan asked.
Yes.
Ted upped the volume.
Kate.
No more apples?
Alyssa.
No, they went fast.
Kate reached into her basket and handed something to Alyssa.
Freeze it, Ethan said.
The image held, Kate's arm outstretched.
What is that? Ethan asked.
A green apple?
Ted rolled video.
Kate, you're always bringing the loveliest fruits and veggies to us. I thought I'd bring you something from my garden.
Alyssa.
What a gorgeous pepper.
Kate.
Thank you.
Alyssa.
I'll have this tonight.
Kate moved out of frame.
Want to see it again? Ted asked.
No, play the next one.
They watched Kate and Alyssa rendezvous three more times. Next day on Main Street, the women passed each other and Alyssa shook her head. The day after, at the Riverside Park, their paths crossed again. This time, Alyssa nodded.
Wonder what that's all about, Ted said.
He glanced at Ethan.
Any ideas?
Not yet.
Ted played Alyssa and Kate's last encounter. It happened the day of Alyssa's death at the community gardens, and the interaction was identical to their first. Kate stopped at Alyssa's vegetable stand, the exchange of a few words. Then Kate handed her another bell pepper. Ted paused the video.
Ethan said, There's probably a note in that pepper.
That says what?
I don't know. Meeting place and time? Instructions for Alyssa to remove her microchip?
Explain something to me. I understand that when these wanderers remove their chips, you can't track them. But don't the cameras still pick up their movement?
No.
No?
Our cameras only key off microchip proximity and motion.
What does that mean exactly?
Look, there's no way to monitor this town using the thousands of cameras all running at once. Most of the time, we'd just be scrolling through empty space. So our cameras key off the microchips. In other words, until a chip moves within range of a sensor, the camera is in sleep mode. It only transmits a video feed when a microchip pings it. And even then, when a chip is motionless for 15 seconds, the camera reverts to sleep mode.
So what you're saying is,
the cameras don't run all the time. When a resident removes their microchip, for all intents and purposes, they become a ghost. Somehow, these wanderers have figured out a way to game the system.
Show me.
Ted brought up a new image.
Here's the last 30 seconds we have of Kate on the night Alyssa was murdered.
On the screens, a bedroom appeared. Kate entered the room wearing a nightgown that fell to her knees. Her husband followed. They climbed into bed together, killed the lights. The overhead camera switched to night vision. The Ballingers lay absolutely still in bed. After 15 seconds, the feed went dark. Next time it picked up, morning light filled the room, and both Kate and her husband were sitting up in bed. Reinserting their chips, Ethan said.
Yes, but all night, from approximately 10:15 until 7:30 the next morning, they were ghosts. And in that period of time, Alitha Pilcher lost her life.
This is why Pilcher really runs the fates, isn't it? Ethan looked at Ted. Am I right? It's not only because he wants the town to police itself. It's because when someone removes their chip, he actually needs our help to find them. Ethan called for Marcus. When his escort arrived, Ethan said, I want to see Alyssa's quarters. They climbed the stairwell, 2 flights to level 4. 5 steps into the corridor, Ethan knew which doorway opened into Alyssa's room by the bunches of fresh flowers scattered across the floor. He wondered if Pilcher had sent someone into town for them. All around the doorframe, the wall had been papered with notes, cards, photographs, banners. Whoever and whatever else Alyssa had been, at least inside this mountain, she was a loved woman.
Sir, the escort said, I got those reports you asked for.
Marcus handed Ethan a manila folder. I'd like to go inside, Ethan said.
Of course.
Marcus took out his keycard and swiped it through the scanner. Ethan turned the doorknob, walked inside. It was a tight living space. Windowless. No more than 100 square feet. A single bed had been positioned against the far wall. There was a desk, a chest of drawers, a wall of bookshelves, half of which held books, the other half framed photographs. Ethan studied them, the photos all of the same woman at varying ages, young girl to 50-year-old woman. Alyssa's mother? Ethan sat down on Alyssa's bed. The wall across the bookshelves was a masterful mural of a beach, palm trees, green water over dark reefs, white sand, a sky that went on forever. Ethan leaned back into the pillows, kicked his boots up on the bed. Smiled. From this angle, when you stared at the mural, it felt like you were there, reclining in the sand, staring off into that false line on the horizon where the sea touched the sky. The folder was entitled Mission Number 1055 Contact Log. He opened it. 5 pages. 5 reports. Day number 5293, from Alyssa Pilcher to David Pilcher. Mission number 1055, contact report number 1. Subject, Resident 308, a.k.a. Kate Ballinger. First contact made at approximately 1125 at the corner of Main and 9th. Note slipped to Kate Ballinger that read, sick of being watched. Brief eye contact made. No words spoken. No further contact was made on this date. Day number 5311, from Alyssa Pilcher to David Pilcher. Mission number 1055, contact report number 2. Subject, Resident 308, a.k.a. Kate Ballinger. 18 days post-initial contact, Ballinger approached me at the gardens and gave me a bell pepper. The pepper had been sliced open, and there was a note inside that read, tracking chip on hamstring in your left leg. Cut it out in a closet, but keep with you until further notice. 2 potential rendezvous times were given for me to confirm I had removed the chip. The first at 1400 on day 5312, the next at 1500 on day 5313. If I failed to remove the chip by day 5313, we would have no further interaction. No further contact was made on this date. Day number 5312. From Alyssa Pilcher to David Pilcher. Mission number 1055. Contact report number 3. Subject, Resident 308, a.k.a. Kate Ballinger. At 1400, I passed Ballinger walking south on Main Street near the intersection of 6th. I shook my head. No further contact was made on this date. Day 5313, from Alyssa Pilcher to David Pilcher. Mission number 1055, contact report number 4. Subject, Resident 308, a.k.a. Kate Ballinger. At 1500, I passed Ballinger walking south on the Riverside Trail. I nodded to her. She smiled. No further contact was made on this date. Day number 5314, from Alyssa Pilcher to David Pilcher. Mission number 1055, contact report number 5. Subject, Resident 308, a.k.a. Kate Ballinger. Ballinger returned to my stand at the gardens with a second bell pepper. The note inside read, "Tonight, 1 a.m., the cemetery mausoleum. Leave your chip in your bedside table. Wear a jacket with a hood. We'll follow up with a new report tomorrow." Ethan moved through the level 3 corridor with his escort in tow. Halfway down, he stopped at a pair of double doors. Through the glass, he saw a full-court basketball game in progress, shirts versus skins. The impact of the ball on the hard wood, the squeak of shoes. For a millisecond, he had the mad thought of joining in the game. They walked on. "Mind if I ask you something, Marcus?"
"Shoot."
"How old are you?"
27.
"And how long have you lived here in the superstructure?"
"Mr. Pilcher brought me out of suspension 2 years ago to replace a guard who was killed on a mission out beyond the fence."
"Everyone in the mountain knew what they were getting themselves into when they signed on with Pilcher, correct?"
"That's right."
"So why'd you do it?"
"Do what?"
Ethan stopped outside the doors to a cafeteria. He faced Marcus. "Why'd you throw your old life away for this?"
"I didn't throw anything away, Mr. Burke. In my life before, you know what I was."
"What?"
"A tweaker and a drunk."
"And what, Pilcher found you? Gave you a chance to be all you could be?"
"I met him just out of prison, a 3-year stint for vehicular manslaughter. I was high and drunk and killed a family on New Year's Eve. He saw something in me I never knew was there."
"Didn't you have a family, friends? A life that was at least your own? What made you trust him in the first place?"
"I don't know. But he was right, wasn't he? We're a part of something here, Mr. Burke. Something that matters. All of us."
"Here's the thing, Marcus, and I don't want you to ever forget it. Nobody fucking asked me, or anyone in that valley, if we wanted to be a part of this." Ethan walked on. At the bottom of the stairwell leading out into level 1, a noise stopped him. Marcus was already swiping his card at the glass door entrance to the cavern. Ethan started down the corridor.
"Mr. Burke, where are you going?"
The noise was something screaming. Banshee-like, tortured, inhuman. He'd heard it before, and it chilled him to his core.
"Mr. Burke!"
Ethan was jogging down the corridor now, the screams getting louder.
"Mr. Burke!"
He stopped at a wide window, stared through the plate glass into a laboratory. There were two men in white coats and David Pilcher. They surrounded an aberration. The creature had been strapped to a steel gurney. Stout leather restraints buckled down across its legs, below its knees and above. One across its torso, another across its shoulders, a fifth securing its head. Its thick wrists and ankles had been clamped down to the sides of the gurney with heavy-gauge steel bracelets, and the thing convulsed against the leather straps as if in the throes of electrocution.
"You shouldn't be here," Marcus said, sidling up to Ethan.
"What are they doing to it?"
"Come on, let's go. Mr. Pilcher won't be happy if he sees..."
Ethan pounded on the glass. Marcus said, "Oh, geez." The men turned, the two scientists scowling. Pilcher said something to them and then walked over to the lab entrance. When the door opened, the Abbey's screams amplified, echoing up and down the corridor like something calling out from hell. The doors whisked closed.
"Ethan, how can I help you?"
"I was on my way out. I heard screams." Pilcher turned toward the plate glass. The Abbey had calmed down or worn itself out. Only its head swiveled under the strap, its screams reduced to croaks. Ethan could see its massive heart beating furiously through its translucent skin. There was no detail, only color and form and motion, all obscured as if behind frosted glass.
"Quite a specimen, no?" Pilcher said. "He's a 317-pound bull, one of the largest males we've ever seen. You'd think he'd be alpha male of a sizable swarm,
but my sniper spotted him coming down the canyon this morning all by his lonesome. Took 400 milligrams of telazol to bring him down. That's the full-grown male adult jaguar dosage, and he was still only sluggish by the time we reached him.
How long did that keep him sedated?
These tranks only work for about 3 hours. After that, you better have them locked up, because boy, do they come back angry.
He's a big boy.
Bigger than the one you tangled with, for sure. I think it's fair to say if you'd met this bull in the canyon, we wouldn't be speaking right now.
What are you doing with it?
Getting ready to remove a gland at the base of its neck.
Why?
Abbeys communicate through pheromones. These are airborne signals that give information and trigger responses.
Don't humans do the same thing?
Yeah, but it's at a much more instinctual, broader level for us. Sexual attraction, mother-infant recognition. Abbeys use pheromones like we use words.
So why are you effectively cutting out that thing's tongue?
Because the last thing we want is for him to tell all his friends he's in trouble. Don't get me wrong. I love the fence. I trust the fence. But several hundred abbeys on the other side trying to figure out how to save their brother makes me a little uncomfortable.
Pilcher glanced down at Ethan's waist.
You still aren't wearing a revolver.
I'm here, in the mountain. What does it matter?
It matters, Ethan, because I asked you to do it. It's a simple thing, isn't it? Wear a gun at all times. Look the goddamn part.
Ethan stared back through the glass. One of the scientists was leaning over the Abbey's face, shining a penlight into its left eye as it hissed. It looked to be between 6 and 7 feet tall, arms and legs like cords of intertwined steel fiber. Ethan couldn't take his eyes off the beast, its black talons as long as his fingers.
"Are they intelligent?" Ethan asked.
"Oh my, yes.
As smart as chimpanzees?
Their brains are larger than ours. Because of obvious communication barriers, testing their intelligence on our terms becomes problematic. I've attempted a battery of social and physical tests, and it's not that they can't do them. They just refuse. It would be like me trying to test you and you telling me to stick it up my ass sideways. That sort of a response. We did capture a somewhat compliant specimen several months ago. She's down in cage 9. Low hostility rating. We call her Margaret.
How low?
I gave her recall tests, sitting across a table from her in her cage. Now, I did have 2 guards behind me pointing shotguns loaded with 12-gauge slugs at her chest. But still, she displayed no signs of aggression.
How'd you test her?
With a simple child's memory game. Walk with me.
Pilcher knocked on the glass and held up 1 finger to the scientists. They moved down the corridor toward the glass doors at the far end, Marcus trailing 10 feet behind.
I use small cardboard tiles. One side is blank. The other has a photograph. A frog, a bicycle, a glass of milk. I arrange them all picture side up on the table and then let Margaret see them. We start easy. 5 tiles, then 10. She gets 2 minutes to study them. Then I turn them over so she can't see the picture. I reach into a bag containing duplicates of the tiles. I show her, for instance, the one with the glass of milk. She touches her talon to the corresponding tile on the table, and I turn it over to see if she got it right.
How'd she do?
Ethan, we worked our way up to 120 tiles, with Margaret only getting 30 seconds to memorize their positions.
And she got them all right?
Pilcher nodded, pride in his voice.
Total recall.
He stopped and pointed at a small window in a door whose only point of access appeared to be a keycard entry.
I keep her in here. Would you like to meet Margaret?
Not even a little bit.
There was a glare off the glass from the overhead fluorescent lights. Ethan cupped his hands around his face and stared into the cage.
I know what you're thinking, Pilcher said, but I don't believe she's an anomaly. Her intelligence, I mean. She's only different in temperament, which is not to say that she wouldn't tear my throat out if she thought she could get away with it.
The cage was only floor, walls, ceiling, monster. The thing called Margaret sat in the corner with its legs curled into its chest. It watched the window and the door through small, opaque eyes that never blinked. "I've already taught her 52 signs. She's a natural learner. Wants to communicate. Unfortunately, her larynx is structured differently than ours to the point of making speech, at least in the sense which we understand it, impossible." The aberration looked almost meditative. It struck Ethan as infinitely more unsettling to see one sitting still and docile. Pilcher said, "I don't know if you saw my report this morning." "No, I came straight here." "We're bringing a prospective resident out of suspension. Wayne Johnson. It's his first day. He's probably waking up in the hospital as we speak. Pam's handling orientation. We'll see how it goes, but you may be called upon to assist in the coming days." "Okay. I hope Ted in surveillance was helpful."
"He was."
"So you'll be reaching out to your old partner soon?"
"Tonight or tomorrow."
"Excellent. You have a game plan?"
"Working on it."
"You will report to me every day on your progress." Ethan said, "David, about your phone call last night."
"Forget it. I just thought you should know."
"I wanted to tell you again how sorry I am for your loss. If you need anything..." Pilcher stared at Ethan, his eyes raging but his voice cool. "Find who did this to my little girl. That's all I need from you. Nothing more."
Chapter 10. Pam was sitting on the end of the bed in her classic nurse's uniform when Wayne Johnson woke up. For a long time, he lay motionless under the comforter, blinking at the ceiling. Finally, he sat up and looked at her. He was shirtless, balding, 42 years old, never married, no children. Wayne had come to Wayward Pines, Idaho on August 8, 1992, as a traveling encyclopedia salesman. He'd arrived late and knocked on five doors. In the evening, after one sale, he checked into the Wayward Pines Hotel and then walked to a family-style restaurant. En route, he was struck by a motorcycle in the crosswalk, a perfect hit-and-run, enough head trauma to render him unconscious, but not enough to kill or permanently damage his brain. In light of the death of Peter McCall two nights ago at the fence, the town was primed for the introduction of a new resident. Wayne Johnson's skin still looked gray. He was only 10 hours post-suspension blood transfusion, but his color would be back by day's end. Pam smiled and said, "Hello there." He squinted at her, his vision probably still blurred as his system rebooted. His eyes darted around the room. They were on the fourth floor of the hospital. The window was cracked, and the white linen curtains pushed in and out as the breeze ebbed and flowed, the rhythm as steady as if the room itself was breathing. Wayne Johnson said, "Where am I?"
"Wayward Pines."
He pulled the covers up around his neck, but it wasn't modesty that drove him.
"I'm freezing."
"Totally normal. You'll feel better by the end of the day, I promise."
"Something happened," the man said.
"Yes, something happened. Do you remember what?"
His eyes narrowed.
"Do you know your name?" Pam asked.
Total amnesia, especially during the first 48 hours, occurred 39% of the time.
"Wayne Johnson."
"Very good. Do you remember what brought you here?"
"I came to sell encyclopedias."
"Yes, good. Did you make any sales?"
"I don't re- one, I think. Yes, one sale."
"And then what happened?"
"I was walking to dinner and..."
She could see the memory of the trauma wash over him, the fear and the shadow of the fear passing across his face.
"Something hit me. I don't know what. I don't remember anything after..." "Is this a hospital?"
"Yes, and this is your town now."
"My town?"
"That's right."
"I don't live here. I live in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska."
"You did live in Scotts Bluff, but now you live here."
Wayne sat up a little straighter.
This was by far and away Pam's favorite part of integration, watching a new resident begin to comprehend that their life, or whatever this new existence was, had irrevocably changed. Nothing beat the fates, but these moments of quiet, devastating revelation were, at least for her, a close second.
"What does that mean exactly?" Wayne Johnson asked.
"It means that you live here now." Sometimes they connected the dots on their own. Sometimes she had to nudge them over the line. She waited a minute, watching the wheels turn frantically behind Mr. Johnson's eyes. He finally said,
"In the accident, was I hurt?"
Pam reached across the bed and patted the lump that was his leg under the blankets.
"I'm afraid you were."
"Hurt bad?" She nodded. "Was I..."
He looked around the hospital room. He looked at his hands. She could feel the question coming. Willed it to come. He was tiptoeing right up to the edge of it.
"Was I..."
Pam thinking, "Ask it, just ask it." The data was conclusive. Almost every time a resident arrived at the question on their own and found the coverage to give voice to it, their integration progressed without incident. Failing to ask the question was a frighteningly accurate prediction for unbelievers, fighters, runners. Wayne closed his mouth, swallowed the question down like a bitter pill. Pam didn't push it, no point in that. It was still early. Still plenty of time to make Mr. Johnson think that he was dead. Chapter 11. Ethan sat at a window table in the steaming Bean, sipping a cappuccino and watching the toy store across the street. It was called Wooden Treasures, and it adjoined a workshop where a man named Harold Ballinger spent his weekdays building toys. His wife, Kate Ballinger, formerly Kate Hewson, formerly Ethan's partner in the Secret Service, worked in the toy store. Ethan had only spoken to her once since coming to Wayward Pines, in the midst of his horrifying integration. But since becoming sheriff, they hadn't said two words to each other, and he'd managed to avoid her entirely. Now he studied her through the glass. She sat at the cash register in the empty toy store, engrossed in a book. It was late afternoon, and the light angling through the storefront glass fired her prematurely white hair into a shock of almost blinding brilliance, like a cumulus cloud backlit by sunlight. He'd read her resident file, read it several times. Kate had lived in Wayward Pines for almost 9 years. When he'd come looking for her, she'd been 36. She would turn 45 in 3 weeks. In their life before, he'd been a year older. Now she had him by 8. Her file told of a brutal integration. She'd fought, tried to escape, pushed Pilcher's patients right up to the brink of ordering a fate. Then she'd simply relented. Settled into her assigned house. Settled into her assigned job. And 2 years later, when the word came down from Pilcher's sheriff at the time, she'd married Harold Ballinger and moved in with him without the slightest protestation. For 5 years, they were model residents. The first surveillance report was triggered off an audio strike from the microphone over their bed. A whispered phrase that just squeaked into the delectable decibel range. Kate's voice. "The Englers and the Goldens are in." Then nothing for a month until Kate's microchip popped one night at 2 a.m. in the cemetery. Sheriff Pope had tracked her down, found her out wandering alone. He'd questioned her, but she played dumb, made her apologies, lied and said she'd had a fight with Harold, needed to get some fresh air. There had been one last incident 2 days later, Harold and Kate disappearing for an hour inside their bedroom closet, which incidentally happened to be one of the few blind spots in the house. The footage was flagged, a report generated, but nothing came of it. There were no further reports for a year and a half until Ted from surveillance sent a memo to Pilcher and Pam. Ethan read it as he sipped his cappuccino. Day 5129. From Ted Upshaw. To David Pilcher. Subjects, Residence 308
and 294, a.k.a. Kate and Harold Ballinger. I've harbored a mounting suspicion over the past few months, which I feel compelled to share with you now. After midnight, once every couple of weeks, in 11 households that we know of, Ballinger, Engler, Kirby, Terrell, Smith, Golden, O'Brien, Nyswander, Green, Brandenburg, and Shaw, the interior cameras produce no video feed for extended periods of time, roughly between 4 and 7 hours. A typical night feed is 2 hours of tossing and turning, with all the motionless activity missing. The only thing that could cause such extended video blackouts would be a complete absence of microchip movement. In other words, no motion to ping the cameras. But this is impossible. For a camera to shut off at night for hours at a time, the subjects would have to sleep perfectly still, or be dead. The cameras are highly sensitive and programmed to wake at the slightest movement, even the rise and fall of someone's chest associated with heavy breathing. The cameras have not been disabled. If this was one instance in one household, I might write it off as an anomaly. But the sheer number of extended blackout occurrences, their repetition, and the fact that they're happening concurrently across multiple households leads me to the conclusion that something bigger, covert, and coordinated is taking place behind our backs. I believe the above-named residents, and possibly more, have not only discovered their microchips, but also found a way to remove them at any time in plain view of the cameras. Obviously, without their microchips embedded, residents could move unseen and undetected in their homes, through town, even beyond the fence. The possibility of a growing contingent of residents meeting together in secret is a disturbing development, which I believe requires immediate action. Ethan polished off the rest of his cap and walked out of the coffee shop into the street. Chimes jingled over the door as he pulled it open and stepped into the toy store. He had breathed deeply, crossing Main, but still his heart was beating like crazy. Kate looked up from the book, a tattered Lee Child paperback, the last Reacher novel. It was her shock of white hair that made her look older from a distance. Close up, she was youthful. A few laugh lines, but still so goddamn pretty. Not long ago, at least from his perspective, he'd been in love with this woman. Their affair had been three of the most intense, reckless, terrifying, happy, alive months of his life. Like how he imagined being on heroin felt, if the high never ended, if every syringe didn't also contain the possibility of death. They'd been partners at the time, and there had been 1 week when they'd been on the road together in Northern California. Every night they rented 2 rooms. Every night for 5 days he stayed with her. They barely slept that week, couldn't keep their hands off each other, couldn't stop talking when they weren't making love, and the daylight hours when they had to pretend to be professionals made it all the more beautifully excruciating. He had never felt such a complete lack of self-consciousness around anyone, even Teresa. Unconditional acceptance. Not just of his body and mind, but also of something more, of something indefinably him. Ethan had never connected with anyone on this level, but the most generous blessing and life-destroying curse all wrapped up in the same woman, and despite the pain of the guilt and the knowledge of how it would crush his wife, whom he still loved, the idea of turning away from Kate seemed like a betrayal of his soul. So she had done it for him. On a cold and rainy night in Capitol Hill, in a booth over glasses of Belgian beer in a loud, dark bar called The Stumbling Monk. He was ready to leave Teresa, to throw everything away. He had asked Kate there to tell her that, and instead she had reached across the scuffed wood of a table worn smooth by 10,000 pint glasses and broken his heart. Kate wasn't married, had no children. She wasn't ready to jump off the cliff with him when he had so much pulling him back from the ledge. 2 weeks later, she was in Boise, pursuant to her own transfer request. 1 year later, she was missing in a town in Idaho in the middle of nowhere called Wayward Pines, with Ethan off to find her. 1,800 years later, after almost everything they had known had turned to dust or eroded out of existence, here they stood, facing each other in a toy shop in the last town on Earth. For a moment, staring into her eyes at close range blanked Ethan's mind. Kate spoke first.
I was wondering if you'd ever drop in.
I was wondering that myself.
Congratulations.
Four. She reached over the counter and tapped his shiny brass star.
Your promotion.
Nice to see a familiar face running the show. How are you adjusting to the new job? She was good. In this short exchange, it was obvious that Kate had mastered the superficial conversational flow that the best of wayward pines could achieve without straining. It's going well, he said.
Good to have something steady and challenging, I bet.
Kate smiled, and Ethan couldn't help hearing the subtext, wondered if everyone did, if it ever went silent. As opposed to running half-naked through town while we all try to kill you.
The job's a good fit, he said.
That's great. Really happy for you.
So, to what do I owe the pleasure?
I just wanted to pop in and say hi.
Well, that was nice of you. How's your son?
Ben's great, Ethan said.
He's sure growing up fast.
That's the truth. God, it felt so stilted talking to her, like bad dialogue in a novel or actors reading lines. Hammering started up next door, Harold building something. How's your husband? Ethan asked. He didn't like the word, not when it applied to the man who'd been fucking Kate for the last 7 years. Or was it possible their marriage was a sham? That she secretly hated him, but kept up appearances? Had never let him touch her.
He's wonderful, she said,
and the authenticity of her smile contradicted everything that had come before, called it all out for the lie it was. She loved Harold. She'd lit up saying his name. In this moment, and only for a flicker of time, Ethan had glimpsed the real Kate. He's next door? Ethan asked.
Yes, that's him hammering away at something.
We like to say he's the brawn and I'm the brains of this operation. Ethan forced a laugh, said, I've never met him. Well, not really met him. He thought she might read his intent, offer to make an introduction. But she only said,
You will.
He's a little under the gun this afternoon, filling an order for the school. Why don't you pick out something for Ben? Anything in the store? On the house?
I couldn't.
I insist.
You're too kind.
Ethan moved away from the cash register. It wasn't a large store, but shelves brimmed, floor to ceiling, with handmade toys. He lifted a wooden car. It had wheels that spun, doors, hood, and a trunk that opened and closed.
This is really good, he said.
Harold's work is amazing. Ethan put the car back on the shelf. Kate moved out from behind the counter. She wore a yellow dress, the color of turning aspen leaves. Her figure almost unchanged.
How old is Ben now? She asked.
He's 12.
Tough age when traditional toys begin to lose their appeal.
She walked to the back of the store. Bare feet on hard wood that almost glowed under the late afternoon light slanting through the storefront windows.
But I might just have the right thing.
She stood on the balls of her feet and reached up to a slingshot on the highest shelf. The craftsmanship was simple but exact. Carved raw wood, sanded smooth. A thick rubber band attached to the forks of the Y and a brown leather pocket.
This is perfect, Ethan said.
It's my pleasure. As he grasped the slingshot, his other hand reached down and touched Kate's hand. The hammering had stopped next door, but the commotion of Ethan's heart sounded deafening in the quiet of the store. He stared down into her eyes, which seemed somehow bluer than he remembered, and unfurled the fingers of her left hand, fighting to ignore the electricity as their skin touched. She didn't pull away. Her eyes flicked down at their hands. She took the scrap of paper from him, clutched it in her fist. Ethan said, "It's really good to see you again," and walked out of the store. The bells jingled on the inner doorknob of Wayward Pines Realty Associates. Teresa looked up from her desk as a man she'd never laid eyes on before walked into her office. She could tell immediately that he was new in town, whatever that meant. He looked sheet-pale and bewildered. Stopping at the edge of her desk, he asked,
"Are you Teresa Burke?"
"I am."
"They said I should talk to you about a house, but I don't really know what..."
"Yes, of course. I can help you with that. What's your name?"
Wayne. Wayne Johnson."
She reached over and shook his hand. "Pleasure to meet you, Wayne. Please have a seat." She pulled out her binder of available listings and slid it across the desk to him. He hesitated. For a moment she wondered if he was on the verge of storming out. But he flipped it open, started turning through the pages. She hated this. It was one thing to help someone who'd been in Wayward Pines for several years upgrade to a new house. They knew the deal, knew how to bullshit. But this poor man had just arrived. He had no idea what was happening to him, why he was here, why he couldn't leave. She wondered if they'd threatened him yet. After a minute, he leaned forward. "See something you like?" Teresa asked. He whispered under his breath.
"What's going on here?"
Teresa said. "What do you mean?" "We're just looking at real estate." "Look, I know buying a new house can be overwhelming, but I'm here to help." And she said it like she almost believed it. Through the storefront window, something caught her eye, across the street. Ethan was emerging from Wooden Treasures with a slingshot in his hand. Through the window behind the kitchen sink, Ethan watched the sky fading toward dusk. Houses began to glow. The valley filled with piano, courtesy of Hector Gaither. A winter's coming chill sharpened the breeze pushing through the screen. Ethan had been noticing it more and more when the sun went behind the mountains. The cold sank almost instantly into town, an aggressiveness to the onset which he found disturbing. He'd heard talk that the winters here were long and legendary. Ethan let his hands linger in the warm dishwater. Suddenly, Teresa was beside him. She set a plate down hard on the butcher block.
"Everything okay?" Ethan asked.
She'd been weird during dinner, weird even for Wayward Pines. Hadn't spoken a word, hadn't taken her eyes off her plate. She looked up at him. "Aren't you forgetting something?" she asked.
"No."
She was angry, her green eyes smoldering. "Didn't you have something for Ben?"
Shit.
She'd seen him. Somehow she'd seen him in the toy shop. But he hadn't brought the slingshot home. He'd gone to his office instead, checked in with Belinda, stashed Kate's gift in the bottom drawer of his desk, hoping to avoid this exact conversation. "What'd you do with it?" she asked. "I think your son would love to own a slingshot."
"Teresa, oh my God, are you actually going to try and deny it?"
He pulled his hands out of the water, dried them on the towel hanging from the stove door handle. Felt an awful metal burn in the back of his throat that reminded him of the night he'd told Teresa about Kate. His ex-partner was already in Boise when he'd sat Teresa down and spilled everything. He couldn't live with the lie between them. Respected her too much. Loved her too much. It had never been about him not loving his wife. Teresa didn't understand. That hadn't been a surprise, but she didn't throw him out either. And that had been. She had cried and been devastated, but in the end, loved him all the same. Still. Despite. And the strangest thing happened, her response made him love her more. Showed him his wife in a light he'd never seen, or rather had missed. Teresa took a step toward him.
"I saw you there," she said. "In her shop. I saw you." "I was there," Ethan said. "She gave me the slingshot for Ben, and I didn't bring it home.
Because you wanted to hide it from me."
"Why would she give me something clearly from her if we were doing something behind your back?"
"But you did hide it from me."
"Yes."
Teresa shut her eyes, and for a moment, Ethan thought she might be on the brink of going to pieces. She opened them again, said,
"Then why did you go to see her?"
Ethan put his hands on the stovetop and leaned back. "It's work, Teresa, and that's all I can say."
"Work.
I would never have gone to her otherwise. And I'm just supposed to take your word for that?"
I love you, and I wish I'd never met her. You have no idea.
What am I supposed to do with that?
Teresa ran the tap and filled a glass, drank it down,